My name's Bill Sanders, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober tonight and happy to be here. Happy to be anywhere. Sober and alive. It's a treat for me to be speaking here in this building tonight because I used to spend I spent hundreds of hours in this building. Right around the corner. Little room more dimly lit than this. And those hundreds of hours that I spent sitting in that little room, I can assure you I never thought about being in this room. That was the furthest thing from my mind. It was also in this hotel the first time, the first of I think only about three or four times that I ever tried cocaine. A member of a rather famous musical group invited some of us to his room and put out some stuff on the coffee table and chopped at it a while and said, try this. And I did, and it must have worked because I woke up on the floor in his room the next morning and didn't remember a thing. So, I don't know if it worked or not. Thank God I was too drunk to find out what the cocaine did. I missed it. It's going to be a nice hotel when they get through with it. They know how to mess up a drunk's mind, give them a room to come into, three great big doors and not a single doorknob on it. You got to figure out. Rhymes of my drinking days, you know, clawing around, trying to figure out how to get in somewhere. Of course, I've spent all my life trying to get in somewhere, trying to belong. And I can say when I found you people or when you found me or when God got us together, for the first time I belonged. And you're in for a great treat this weekend. Atlanta Roundup is always, always good. And the speaker tomorrow night, Polly Pistol, and she is a pistol. You will love her if you've never heard Polly. And I want you to make Polly and Dave feel very much at home. And I wish I was going to be able to be around all weekend. Unfortunately, I've got to fly out in the morning, but I'm glad to be around this weekend. And whatever you do, don't miss my buddy Sterling on Sunday morning. And this is Sterling's first trip to Atlanta. And I told him if he ever got down here, we'd show him what real Southern hospitality is all about. So, Sterling, stand up. I want to see who you are so they can make you feel at home there. We're glad to have Sterling and Roxanne here for the weekend. And y'all have a wonderful weekend. Alcoholics Anonymous is the single most important thing that has ever come down the pike in my lifetime. As I said earlier, when I used to sit in the bar here at what was then the Radisson and drink my life away, I certainly never dreamed of being an AA. I never dreamed of being AA in my life. I've said many times that when I sat in those little classes and when I was growing up in school and on the back of a pad, notepad making notes of all the clubs, organizations, institutions, country clubs and things I wanted to join when I got big, AA wasn't in the Hot 100. Never had any plans for being an alcoholic. I just didn't fit in. But I can tell you today, with every other club, organization, institution, group that I have joined through the years, you can have them all if you'll leave me AA. Because it was only in Alcoholics Anonymous that I found myself. I found the myself I believe that God intended for me to be. And I had searched all of my life for that. Like most alcoholics as a kid, I was a proverbial square peg looking for a square hole, and they were all round. And I never felt that I belonged anywhere. Never. Now, the kids that grew up with me said that's the most ridiculous thing. Bill Sanders was a member of every club, group, organization that came down the pike. And I was. School, church, scouts, you name it, I joined it. But I never belonged to anything. I could be in the middle of a crowd of people, right in the middle of a circle of people, and I would feel like an outsider looking in. I always felt like everybody else knew something that I didn't know. They had some kind of information that I didn't have. And no matter how hard I tried, the less I fit. I didn't have my first drink until I was 15 years old. I hear some people in here talk about having a drink when they were 3, and some people having 10 or 12, you know. I didn't have Didn't have a drop till I was 15 because I did not come from a family that drank. I just never part of the life of my immediate family. It was in sort of the outreaches of my family, but not in my immediate family. But all of those fears that I talked about were there from my very earliest memory. But it was when I was 15 years old that one Saturday night, some friends asked if I wanted to go cross over the Savannah River from Georgia into South Carolina and buy beer and have a drink, that the light got turned on that night. I don't know if it was curiosity or peer pressure or what, but I said yes. And we went over into South Carolina and we bought there was a little joint over there that you could pull up in back of it and toot the horn three times, and the guy'd come out, and if you could see over the steering wheel, he'd sell you the beer. And he sold us a case of beer, and we came back and sat on the banks of the old muddy Savannah River, right about the middle of where Lake Hartwell is today. And someone popped open I think it was a Pabst Blue Ribbon and handed it to me, and I had my first drink. And it was beyond a shadow of a doubt the most vile, putrid, god-awful tasting stuff I had ever put in my mouth. Only drank six that night. It was terrible tasting stuff, but there is something very amazing that happened, that as I know from my experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous, happened to many, many of us, and that is somewhere between the second and the third beer, a little bell went off in the back of my head. And in that moment, little Billy Sanders wasn't afraid anymore. In that moment, all of that fear and that anxiety just went away. And in that moment, I became smarter and wittier and handsomer and sexier than I had ever been in my entire life, or anybody I'd ever known in my entire life. And in that moment, either consciously or subconsciously, I made a decision that as pukey as that stuff in that can tasted, I had found a friend. Because that magic elixir was going to be my friend for the rest of my life if it could do this for me. And it was to do that for me for many years. Somewhere along the line, as you all know, it quits doing for and starts doing to. But back then it was for. And you know, all of the years that I drank, and I like to talk about this for a minute because It goes with our, as Clancy calls it, disease of perception. It was always my perception that alcohol did for other people what it did for me. That it gave them what it gave me. And I have found out that it doesn't. There are people who can come home and have a hard day at the office or at work, and they can have a beer or they can drink a martini and they feel a little bit relaxed and they're ready for dinner and they eat dinner and they watch TV a while and they go to bed and the liquor cabinet doesn't say a single word to them. The bottle doesn't talk to them at all. and I just, you know, I don't understand people like that. I hear people talking about having a drink. And my mind, even after some 24 hours around this program, still says, what good is a drink? I mean, a drink, words don't even go together. I mean, what earthly good is a drink? Hey, you know, a real big drink, you know, like this. But there are people who can somehow do that. And alcohol is not a real important part of their lives. And, you know, most of them go a long time without saying, maybe I might have a problem. It doesn't come up. Either way, I mean, you know. But alcohol, that very first night that I drank, got me drunk. Which, you know, should have been some kind of a clue, but it obviously wasn't. And I didn't drink that much in high school because in the little bitty town I grew up in, like all little bitty towns, there is one thing they're real short on, and that's anonymity. Everybody knows everybody else's business. And everybody knew in our town who the town drunk was. I told you it was a little town. We didn't have but one town drunk, I thought. You know, to me, the alcoholic, the resident alcoholic in our town, was Tom Kaysen, who slept on the park bench, peed on his shoes, right down his trouser leg, and burped a lot. And I thought, well, that's what I don't want to become. And guess what? I almost never did. Started to tell a little lie there, but I, you know. But after a while, I went off to college, and when I went off to college, I discovered that when I was thrust into a student population over in Athens that was almost three times the whole population of my whole hometown, I found out what anonymity was, and nobody cared how much I drank. And nobody kept count, and nobody even noticed when I wasn't in class. And so I started drinking every day. And I discovered that in many instances that liquor was quicker than beer, and some of it even tasted better. And so I was off and running. I know today that it was then that I was caught up in the full-blown throes of alcoholism. It's interesting, when I first got to this fellowship, you could ask me, how long, Bill, have you been drinking alcoholically, and put me on the lie detector, and the needle wouldn't move an inch if I said, well, about a year and a half, 2 years before I got here. The strange thing is, as most of you know, the longer you stay here, the further back it goes, you know. I can honestly tell you today that I believe with all my heart that I was born an alcoholic. At the age of 15, I began that journey toward becoming a drunk. And it took until I was almost 40 years old to just be an alcoholic again. And I say just be an alcoholic because I don't have any problem today in being called an alcoholic. I never thought I'd see the day when I'd be proud to say I'm an alcoholic, but I am. I'm proud to say that I am a recovering member of this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm not a drunk anymore. And I used to have to wear the tag as a drunk for many years because I couldn't deny it. It was completely undeniable. But today, I'm not a drunk anymore. Thanks to you people, thanks to God, and thanks to this fellowship. But throughout college, I stayed in a lot of trouble, and I can give you a lot of war stories that I'm going to mercifully spare you tonight. Some of them I know firsthand. Some of them I've been told about. Because you see, in college, I started having spells. It wasn't until I got here that I got to another name for them, blackouts. But back when they were just spells, I would lose a few days. I mean, just, you know, go out and party on Saturday night and wake up Tuesday. And somebody's been screwing around a calendar since I... throughout college, I did stay in a lot of trouble, and I did miss a lot, I know, of what went on in college or what should have gone on in college. One of the experiences of my college career is one that was rather life-changing for me. One Saturday night, my roommate and I were visiting in another friend's apartment after we had been on a trip to Atlanta. We had borrowed his car and we returned it to him. We were sitting in his apartment drinking, and around 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the metamorphosis had started in my head that often changed my personality, and I became what I was more and more often becoming, a total blithering idiot. About 3 o'clock in the morning, and I reached up on the wall and took down an old long barrel Colt 22 pistol out of a big antique gun collection that the guy had in his apartment. And I pointed at my roommate and I said, "Stick 'em up." And he threw up his hands in surrender. And I was trying to act like Matt Dillon or Wyatt Earp, and he threw up his hands and I pulled the trigger, and there was a sound like thunder. And in a moment, my roommate was lying on the floor in front of me in a pool of blood. A few hours later, at a local hospital, they were to tell me that my roommate would live, but that he would never walk again. The bullet had severed his spine. A very strange thing happened in the early morning hours of the following morning in a hospital over in Athens. My roommate reached up from a hospital room bed and he put his hand on my arm and he said, "Bill, for God's sake, don't blame yourself. Don't blame yourself. It was an accident. It could just as easily have been the other way around." He had forgiven me immediately. But I didn't forgive myself for more than 20 years. Because, you see, I didn't know how. I didn't have the tools of this fellowship. It was not until you people, through a loving and merciful God, put into my hands the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, eighth, the ninth step, that I was able to find peace and relief in that incident and in many that were to happen in my life in the years to come. It's not long after that incident that I began to crawl deeper and deeper into the bottle. I came that summer and worked here in Atlanta for a period of 3 months, and then went back to school in the fall and tried to get going for my senior year in college. And it all came crumbling down around me, and so I put a plan together to bring it all to an end. And I did it very simply. I would go to the college infirmary and tell the doctors there, as I went to see them on a rotating basis, that I was having trouble sleeping. And they'd prescribe sleeping pills, and I'd take them down the hall to the pharmacy and get them filled, take them home, put them in the nightstand drawer in the dormitory, and kept doing that week after week until I got a good supply of them together. And then I waited till one Friday afternoon when my new roommate was headed home for the weekend, and he had bought a brand new car, first new one he'd ever owned, and he was taking it home to show it to his family. And I put my plan into action as I watched his car pull out of the parking lot, and I saw him drive out of sight. I closed the drapes of the blinds and sat down on the side of the bed and emptied all those little bottles out on the nightstand of what was later determined to be between the somewhere around 50 or 60 sleeping pills. And one by one, two by two, swallowed them down and turned out the lights and pulled up the covers. And I believe for more than 20 years that it was a huge coincidence that my roommate's brand new car cocked out at the city limits of Athens and had to be towed back to the dealership. And that he'd come into that dormitory room and saw all those little bottles, knew the frame of mind I'd been in, and called an ambulance. I said I believe that it was a coincidence because I don't believe in coincidences anymore. I love the definition I heard in these rooms some years ago that a coincidence is a miracle in which God chooses to remain anonymous. And I believe that with all my heart today. I believe that was the first of many times that the God you people were to introduce me to years later had looked down and said, "Big boy, I'm not through with you yet." And for what purpose? He has preserved my life through the years, through all of the insane behavior, the crazy insane places I would find myself, the wrecked cars, the jail cells. I don't know what that purpose is, but it is my hope and my prayer that I can stay sober, ask for His will every day, and be in the right place at the right time for whatever that purpose may be. They did take me to the hospital. Oh, by the way, one other thing about that brand new car that stalled out. When they took it back to the dealership, the first time they tried to crank it, it cranked. And it cranked every time after that. They never did find anything wrong with that car. Go figure. But anyway, after this incident, I began the great American institution of visiting the friendly neighborhood shrink. I have no idea how many of those people I saw through the years or how many thousands of mine and my family's dollars went to pay them. But I saw a bunch of them. One of them I went to was a well-known doctor. He was one of two doctors that collaborated in treating a patient and ultimately writing a book and making a movie called The Three Faces of Eve. And it was about this woman who had three personalities. And I remember thinking, "Time, what's the big damn deal about that? I got about 36 up here." If I could get mine down to three, I could handle that. But every one of those doctors I'd go to see, I would walk in and sit down in their offices and then spend an hour and then walk out damning them because none of them ever did anything in this world to help me. Now, I always am forced to say that in view of the fact that this is a program of rigorous honesty, I'm forced to admit that there is at least a remote possibility that one or more of them might have been able to help me if I had ever once told them the truth. Invariably, somewhere around the third or fourth question, they ask, "Do you think you might have a drinking problem?" And my standard answer is, "No, I drink fine." And they'd go off treating something else and giving me a pill for it. I eventually did exit the University of Georgia. I did it with a diploma in my hand. I've never been sure if I earned it or if they just got tired of me making trouble over there. But I'm not going to ask. And I ended up in another town in North Georgia, and I went to work there in the profession that I've been in all of my life, the broadcasting business. And I went to work for a radio station. And at the time I thought, you know, you're out of college now. You need to settle down. You need to get your life together. You need to become a responsible citizen of the community. And I did. I got that great job. I was a news anchor and a news director of a station, and I joined the church, joined local civic clubs, got involved in scout work. Oh, and I joined a local fraternal order that had one of only two bars in town. And I really doubt if I need to tell y'all which one ended up getting most of my attention. It wasn't the Boy Scouts. I pretty well lived to, you know, get through with work every day and head for the bar, head for the club. And it wasn't long after going to that club that I met a beautiful girl. And we hit it off real quick, and I thought, golly, gee, she's cute. I would like to have her be part of my life. And I thought, you know, if you want to do that, you probably need to clean up your act and cut down on your drinking some. Until a few weeks later, I discovered I didn't need to do any such thing. That woman liked drink just as much as I did. A few months later, we were engaged, and then in December of 1966, we were married, and she became my first wife. And we were off and running. We went to our separate jobs every day. Mine at the broadcast station, and hers, she was a bookkeeper, and she'd go to work, and I'd go to work, and she'd get off in the afternoon about 5. She'd go home and wait for me, and then I would get off work as soon as I finished the 6 o'clock news at night. I'd go home, pick her up, and we were off to the club. And we lived to get to the club every night, and we'd get into the club, and we'd sit down and start ordering drinks. Sometimes we'd order dinner. Not very often, but even more rarely, we'd eat it once in a while. But I wasn't big on eating when I was drinking. It, you know, messed up my buzz. I don't... And a few months or a year or two after that, as we went rocking along merrily our way in our living our lives either in the bar or at work, or passed out at home, she came home one day and said, guess what, we're going to have a baby. And we talked. Said, well, something else took happened during one of those spells. Must not have been in the club all the time. And we thought that we talked a lot during the 9 months that were to come that, well, we're going to be parents. We need to learn how to become respectable parents. And we did. In February of 1970, a beautiful little blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl came into our lives. My wife and I cleaned up our act. We became responsible parents. We changed diapers, and we made formula, and we did all of those great parental things for, gosh, I don't know, 3-4 weeks. It was great. And then we discovered the Grand American Institution of the Babysitter, and we were right back out there in the club again. And I know now that that was, I guess, probably the beginning of the end of that marriage, because well, you know, it's funny. I hear people in this program that where relationships don't last, they talk about problems of communication. That's the one thing I can't really relate with, because my wife and I communicated. That was not our problem. You could ask our neighbors 3 doors down the street, and they tell you the Sanders communicate. They could even probably give you word for word what we were communicating about. Our communication sessions were fairly basic. They were fairly simple, followed a particular pattern. Sunday afternoon was the best time for communicating, you know, plenty of time uninterrupted. And I could hang in there with the best of them until it became apparent that I was on the losing end of the discussion. And when it got to be apparent that I was on the losing end of the discussion, we go to Plan B. Plan B is simply grab your bottle, storm out the back door, slam the door, get in the car, peel up the driveway, out of here. I don't have to stay here listening to this garbage. Over and over and over again, that would happen. One Sunday afternoon, we got into a discussion, and I had all my facts and figures, dates and places together. Couldn't possibly lose this one. 10 minutes in, I'm losing. Plan B, grab the bottle, storm out the back door, peel up the driveway, out of here, just like 100 other Sunday afternoons. Only difference this Sunday afternoon, I still had my pajamas on. Well, my wife did what any sweet, loving, caring, thoughtful wife would do. She sent a friend to come get me and bring me home. The only thing wrong with that picture is the friend she sent happened to be a police captain. And he found me sitting in the parking lot of the Holiday Inn, minding my own business, sitting there talking to my bottle. And he came up and rapped on the car window. I looked up, I saw him, knew who it was immediately, and I said, "Hey, Harold." He suggested I get out of my car and get into the squad car with him, and he'd take me home. And I told him that he could... I said, "No, thank you." And then he started talking to me about his relative size to my size and about his Marine Corps wrestling medals and his the impact of that club hanging on his belt up the side of a human head. And, you know, the more he talked, the more it made sense I might want to think about going with him. I was drunk. I wasn't stupid. I also wasn't so drunk I knew in about two turns we weren't heading toward my house. In about two more turns I knew where we were headed because he pulled into the emergency room parking lot of the local hospital. And before I could say a word of protest, he had opened that police car door, ushered me out of that car, into that emergency room, upstairs, checked into a room, flat out in the bed, zip, blap, boom. You won't believe how fast you can get checked in a hospital when you already got your pajamas on. It's something about public relations. Most hospitals got this thing about drunks in their pajamas with vodka bottles under their arms sitting in the lobby. It don't look good. So the next time you're worried about all those insurance papers... About 3 weeks later, I checked out of that hospital. Learned anything? No. Drunk before the sun went down on the day I got out. And it was not long after that that my wife and I did the only logical, sensible thing that we could do to tackle where we were in our lives then. We moved. You know, if it's worse here, it's got to be better over there. Matter of fact, I've heard it's better over there. They say that it's better over there. As my late granddaddy's sponsor said, the only problem is by the time we get over there, it's all changed. It's moved on somewhere else. And we moved back to Atlanta. Back to Atlanta for me and to Atlanta for the first time for my wife. And I got involved in a part of the broadcasting business that I've been in since then and involved, among other things, something called public relations. And I guess the interesting thing about that was that I took that job and came to work down here and I didn't even know what public relations was. I mean, that little town I grew up in the hills of North Georgia, people didn't have relations in public. I mean, you know, I didn't understand that stuff. But I did discover there were some aspects of this thing called public relations that I liked. One was a thing called a three-martini lunch. Five was better, but if my number, but if three was yours, you know, what the heck. And another thing they had called a happy hour. That's where you go in and order and pay for one drink, and they give you two, sometimes three. And I could get into that. Did. Often. Down the hall here. And it didn't take me long at all to discover that if you take those five martini lunches and you stretch them a little longer and you go to the happy hour earlier and you just kind of keep shoving the two together and you don't even have to go back to work in the afternoon. Today I know by that time, I was in the full-blown throes, the grasp, the bounds of Alcoholics Anonymous, or of alcoholism. And one of the aspects of my alcoholism that I had no clue to back then, but that I know today, and that is the set of blinders that it gave me. My disease gave me a set of blinders that didn't allow me to see a lot of what was going on around me. One of the things that it didn't allow me to see is that when I didn't come back from one of those long liquid lunches, that it suited the people who worked for me just fine. Because while the fellow who came in the morning was capable of being a pretty nice guy, the one who came back from one of those long lunches was not a very nice person. He was argumentative. He was forgetful. He was judgmental. At times downright mean. But you see, I didn't see that. I was also not able to see that my little girl, who is by now 5 or 6 years old, doesn't invite friends over to spend the night anymore, because she never knew when Dad's going to come home in the middle of the night in a drunken rage, smashing furniture, throwing televisions through plate glass windows, dragging her out of the bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, then demanding that she go do something ridiculous like clean a drop of spilled milk off the kitchen cabinet all the time, telling her how stupid and ignorant and dumb and clumsy she was. My disease did not allow me to see this. It didn't allow me to see that the only look in her eyes was one of fear and of hate and of disgust. More often than not, of course, I wouldn't even remember these middle of the night insane fits of behavior, but I had a wife who would gleefully fill me in on all the details the next morning. She'd be telling me all that stuff I did about destroying the television and everything, and I'd be saying, wasn't me, did not, could not, would not. Of course, I'm saying this as she is pulling my shoe out of the television picture tube. Then I would look into the kitchen, and there sitting at the dining table would be a little girl hovering down low over a bowl of cereal, hoping not to be noticed. And I would go in and I'd say, "Sweetheart, you and I need to take a walk." And I would take her by the hand and we'd go walking out down the sidewalk. And I said, "Karen, Mom told me what I did last night, dragging you out of the bed at 3 o'clock and making you clean up your room or clean up the kitchen cabinet or whatever, and all the things I said to you, and I don't remember it, but I want you to know I'm sorry. And I want to promise you that it will never, ever, ever, ever happen again." And my disease did not allow me to see that there wasn't even a flicker of belief in that little girl's eyes. Because you see, she'd heard too many empty lies, too many empty promises. She wasn't buying it anymore. The roller coaster of my disease was in full swing now. More and more often I would wake up in strange places, in strange beds with strange people. More and more often not coming home at night, losing more and more days. You know, I'd have a business trip to New York and I'd go out to the Atlanta airport. And I'd get there a little early so I could stop and have a drink before I got on the plane. And I'd have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I'd miss the plane. You've heard those commercials? Delta is ready when you are? Uh-uh. They'll leave you. So I just go get on another plane, go somewhere else. And I'd call home that night and ask my wife, "Say, how you doing?" She'd, "Fine, how's everything in New York?" "I ain't in New York, I'm in New Orleans." You know how I knew I was in New Orleans? Because when I came to, I looked in the nightstand drawer and that's what it said on the front of the phone book, New Orleans. I knew that's where I was. You know, a lot of things I had to find out information. You know, I'd go on business trips, and you back and say, how's your trip? Where have I been? And so I'd sit down and get credit card receipts and try to put them in chronological order and say, oh yeah. That is as long as I had credit cards. Near the end, I couldn't even get a gasoline card. Of course, you know, there's a lot of information you have to find out the hard way, like in the mornings getting up to go look out the window and see if your car's there. And if it's not there, trying to piece it together and figure out where you were last night and trace it back and then go, you know, the only thing worse is looking out and part of your car is there. And you don't know where the rest of it is. I remember the night that I got up the next morning and I went out and all four tires were flat. And I called the Gulf Station. They came up and fixed the tire. And while the guy's fixing tires, I was telling him about how somebody come in there during the night and slashed all my tires. And he's asking me, well, how'd the rims get bent up so bad? Beats the hell out of me. I don't know. I wasn't here. You know, you don't ask drunk that early in the morning to figure out something like that. By now, I'm going in my directions, and my wife's going in her directions, and she's drinking. One of those rare nights when I'd come home and sleep in my own bed and run my arm under my pillow like she knew I always would, and there's this piece of paper under there, and I pull it out and unfold it and look at it through one eye. And it's that pamphlet with those damn questions in it. I get to about the third one, so I don't want to understand. She just kept going to meetings, going to meetings, going to meetings. And eventually it happened. I knew it was gonna. God help her. She came home one day and she says, I'm going tonight to pick up a 90-day chip and I'd like for you to be there. I said, no way. Uh-uh. Ain't gonna happen. Please, few tears, few deals, few bargains. Finally, I says, okay, on one condition, I go in my car. You see, she'd be gone 2 or 3 hours and I'd ask her, I said, how long are these meetings? An hour. How come you gone 3? Oh, we went to Coco's and had coffee. Yeah, right. Well, I didn't know where she was going. I just knew I wasn't going. So I said, where are we going? She said, we're going to a place called 8111 Club. I said, where's that? She said, follow me. So I got in the car and I followed her out down Roswell Road. And she turned up this pretty little driveway in this little house sitting up on the hill in the grove of trees. And I thought, this is ironic as it can be, because I'd pass that house hundreds of times on my way home from the bar, and every time I'd pass that house, I'd look up there and say, you know, you really ought to get to know the guy that lives there, because he obviously has a party every night. Well, that night, old Bill went to the party. And I slipped in, it used to be the back door, it used to be an old sliding glass door, and I slid that door open, slid in behind a post at the back of the room, and I hunkered down low so nobody could see me there, and for the next hour I witnessed the biggest bunch of weirdos I'd ever seen in my life. They read all that stuff at the beginning of the meeting, they got through with it, and some guy raised his hand, and they pointed to him, and that guy right out loud gave them his name and told them that he was an alcoholic. And they seemed real happy to see him. They all hide him, you know. And I'm sitting there thinking, if I was him, I don't think I'd have told that. And then if that wasn't enough, he told him he'd gotten 3 DUIs. And you know what they did? They busted out laughing. It's a sick bunch, I'll tell you. And the thought that was going through my mind is, don't they know what they are? They're alcoholics. They ain't got anything to laugh about. I say that in reminder tonight because I can tell you today I thank God every day of my life for the laughter that we share in these rooms, because there is magic and there is power and there is healing in that laughter. I believe in it. And if you don't have a home group like mine, God bless them, the Mount Vernon group, if you don't have a group that laughs a lot, then go find one that does. I will also admonish you, don't laugh all the time or they'll come get you. Seen it happen. Well, that meeting went on and on. The second person raised his hand, told him he was an alcoholic, and they seemed real glad to see him. And he told him he had gotten 5 DUIs and been arrested for indecent exposure. They came unglued. And the more I listened, the more I thought, my God, if they knew some of the stuff that had happened to me, I could sound like Richard Pryor. Well, that meeting went on and on, and finally everybody stood up, and I started for the door, and somebody grabbed me by the hand from both sides, and they said the only thing familiar to me that night, and that was the Lord's Prayer, and I was out the door heading across there to get into the parking lot just as fast as I can go. And I got about 2/3 of the way across the parking lot, and something grabbed me by the shoulder that felt like a steel vise, spun me around, and I found myself looking up into the face of a man that was 7'11". I know tonight he's only, I think it's 6'6", but he looked a hell of a lot taller that night. I also remembered him from the meeting. Some of you know him. He's still around. I remembered him from the meeting because he was a little different from everybody else. Everybody else said, my name's Joe, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Mary, I'm an alcoholic. My name's... When they called on this guy, he said, my name's Floyd, and I'm a grateful hillbilly drunk. Give me a break. And this guy got talking to me about driving the school bus drunk and dropping out of fifth grade or whatever it was he went through and drinking moonshine up in the mountains. And I'm going, God, what in the hell is he talking about? Why is he telling me this? God, I don't even know who I am. Found out later he knew exactly who I was because she'd been talking about me in those meetings. People came out and getting their cars and leaving. Remember, I went in my car, by God, so I can get out of here. My wife comes out, goes by, and gets in her car and leaves, and it's me and Floyd. And... he talks about getting drunk out in the woods and around in the North Georgia mountains in the wintertime and falling down on the ground and his face freezing to the ground. And they had to pour coffee on him to get him up. And I'm not hearing about half of this because I'm making a deal with God. God, if you'll get me out of this... Floyd talked on there for, about 3 days. And I finally got away from him, got in my car, and headed home as hard as I could go. Walked in the house. My wife started to say something. I said, don't open your mouth. Don't you ever, ever try to get me back in that nut house again. And she didn't, and the roller coaster ride continued. The elevator was going in one direction. And I could but have but a faint memory of the fancy places that I used to drink. But you see, it wasn't that way anymore. It wasn't classy anymore either. Let me tell you something. When you wake up in the morning and you look down and you realize there's dew all over your clothes, and you blink trying to figure out where you are, and all you can see is the nostrils of a policeman's horse. That ain't classy. There's also not a good answer when he says, what are you doing here? All I could say is, where's here? This is Piedmont Park. Say what? There's also no class when you're dragged from a car you've planted into a steel post over on Lake Forest Avenue. You're frisked, cuffed, slammed into the back of the police car, hauled into the North Fulton jail, arguing with the police officer all the way, there is no conceivable possible way on the face of this earth that I could be, that I'm drunk. I am not. I have not had but two beers. Did not. That's all we ever had, you know, was two beers. And, you know, that's all I had, my quota. You know, that was it. Had two beers, and he put me on that breathalyzer. He got through with that thing. I said, there's no way on the face of this earth that two beers could be producing 0.28. He agreed with me. The only thing we did agree on that night. On the afternoon of July 26, 1982, I came out of a week-long blackout drunk. Whole week missing. And on that Monday afternoon, when I came out of that blackout, I opened my eyes and looked down, and I was sitting in my recliner chair at home. And in my left hand, there was an empty bottle. And in my right hand, there was a fully loaded and cocked .22 pistol. And I had not remembered picking up either one of them. And the thought that was going through my head is this all there is? Is this really all there is? Because if it is, you can have it. And through the fog of that Monday afternoon, at about twilight, there came a voice. The voice of God? Not exactly. Voice of an angel? Not directly. It was the voice of a beautiful, wonderful, lovable, strapping, hillbilly drunk named Floyd. And the words that cut through the pain of that hangover that Monday afternoon were simply this. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I expected God to open the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't, but he opened the gates of hell and let me out. And if where I was on the afternoon of July 26, 1982 can be any closer to hell on this earth, I pray that I never know. I got up out of that chair and I walked into the bathroom, cleaned myself up as best I could. Gargled about a half a bottle of Listerine. Drank the rest. All that was left. Drove the few miles back to that little club on the hill. Slipped into the back door down behind that same post. And peeked around it at the front of the room. And folks, don't ever try to convince this alcoholic that God doesn't have a sense of humor. Because sitting there at the front of that room, chairing that meeting, sat my wife. I don't remember anything that was said at that meeting that night. But at the end of the meeting, a man stood up and he explained the meaning of those chips. And I heard the word surrender. And I heard the words sick and tired. And I got up out of my chair and I took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life to the front of that room. And a man pressed into my hand, trembling and sweating though it was, a white poker chip. My hand closed around it and I walked back and I sat down. I choose to believe that an old Bill Sanders walked to the front of that room that night and died. And that a new one walked away. Because by the grace of a loving God and the tender loving care that he delivered me into your hands, in rooms like this, in meetings like this, I have not had a drink since that night. And I thank him every day. You applaud yourselves and our fellowship. And I say, an old Bill Sanders died and a new one walked away, because I hear people in this program saying we get a new start, a new beginning. I don't think so. I think we get a new life, a clean slate. We get to start all over again. You know, it says in there, restore to sanity. That's assuming I ever had any to begin with. I don't think I did. To be happy, joyous, and free. I hadn't even known what those words meant. Very early in the fellowship, you told me that I needed to get a sponsor. I thought that's real weird. I've been in broadcasting all my life. I've had hundreds of sponsors. Until you explained what kind of sponsor you meant. And I said, oh, okay. So I decided to do that one scientifically. I looked around for the sweetest, kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired old granddaddy that I could find. One that would pat me on the head on a daily basis and tell me exactly what I wanted to hear, when I wanted to hear it, and to tell me that I was working this program better than anybody he'd ever seen. Just keep doing what you're doing, son. And I found him. Snow-white hair, roly-polier than I am, big smile on his face all the time. And I said, there he is. And I asked Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. Biggest mistake I ever made in my life. In the years that that man was my sponsor, I don't remember him ever telling me one damned thing I wanted to hear. I remember I knew I was in trouble that first day. The first day I asked him to be my sponsor. He's okay, we'll sponsor each other now. Let's talk about the rules. Rules? What rules? He said, real simple. When you wake up every morning, you're going to roll out of that bed onto your knees and you're going to ask God to keep you sober today. And the last thing you're going to do at night is you're going to get back down there on your knees and you're going to say, thank you. And I drew myself up and I said, Doc, I said, well, you know, I grew up as a kid going to church. After all, I'm a recovering Southern Baptist too. And church doors opened, we were there. I know prayer is an important part of this fellowship. I've seen that the last few weeks I've been around here, but I just got to be honest with you, Doc. I'm not comfortable at all with this knee business. He looked me right in the eye and said, son, I didn't say a damn thing about you being comfortable. And then I got real cocky with him, as he had with his sponsor before, I found out later, and I said, Doc, I thought this was a program of suggestion. He says, it is. I suggest you do it or get you another sponsor. That's how we began our journey. Then he gave me that book. And he says, I want you to take this book home and I want you to read the first 164 pages of it. And I want you to study it. Not just read it, study it. The next several weeks. Especially that chapter 5, those steps. And when you get through studying it, you come back and we're going to sit down and we're going to talk about how you're going to make that work in your life. And I said, all right, I can get into that. I can handle that. So I've stopped off at the office supply store on the way home and I got myself a box of sharp pencils and I got me a couple of legal pads and I got me a box of those highlighters and I went home and I cleaned off my desk and I spread all that stuff out and I went to work. And I was highlighting and I was underlining and I'm making notes and I struck through the steps that didn't have anything to do with me. And I made notes of the margins that I thought of, the things that y'all hadn't thought of. And filled up about half one of those legal pads, and about 2.5 weeks later, I called him and said, all right, Doc, been studying, ready to talk. He said, hot dog, come on over. So I loaded it all up, went over to his house, spread it out on the coffee table. He reared back in his recliner chair and said, lay it on me. And I flipped that book open to chapter 5, and I pointed in there, and I said, all right, looking here at this first step, as I interpret, and that's as far as I got. He said, boy, that step don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing. I said, I know, Doc, but what I think it means is, he said, Bill, look real close. You'll notice they wrote it in English. It says exactly what it means. If you look even closer, you'll see they put little numbers by those steps so smart college boys like you can follow along. God, was he tough. That was the beginning of my journey through the steps. One of Doc's favorite lines, what step you on? I made a mistake one time saying, no, I'm not on any step, I'm just coasting. He said, fine, as long as you know one thing, you only coast in one direction, down. And we were zipping on along through the steps. You know, great little exercises, those steps. And one day I was at work and I had a personnel problem and I poured over it all day trying to figure out what in the world to do about it. Couldn't come up with an answer. I said, I know what I'll do. Doc had business experience. I'll ask him tonight. So I got to the meeting a little early and pulled him off to the side. I said, I got a business. question to ask you, Doc. I want to ask you about this personnel problem I got. Let me lay it out to you. You see, and he said, what step are you using on it? I said, what? What step are you using on the personnel problem? I said, none. This ain't got nothing to do with steps. He said, go look again. So I went on home that night and I got steps down. One, two, three. Ain't a damn thing in here about personnel problems. Went back the next night, corner began. I said, Doc, I looked in steps. Nothing in there to cover what I'm talking about. Let me lay out the problem. He said, go look again. I went home, got the book out, opened up, started going, crazy old bastard. There it was. There was the answer. You see, he sent me back to that book, into those steps, over and over and over and over and over again, until finally it clicked in this sick alcoholic head of mine that there is nothing, nothing, nothing that is going to happen in the life of this alcoholic that the answer is in that book and in those steps. I believe that it's the greatest owner's manual that has ever been written. And if you are a drunk, or if you own one, you ought to have that book. I'm a big believer in Al-Anon's reading that book. We worked our way through those steps, and we're moving right along. You know, I hear people say, you know, when you're going to work do a fourth step, oh, well, you'll know when you're ready. Doc said, that's the biggest bunch of crap in the world. You don't even know when it's time to go to the bathroom, much less when to work a step. I'll tell you when you're ready, and he did. And we're moving right along through those things, and I'm realizing we're going to be through here before you know it. And I said, Doc, I got by his favorite trap. I said, Doc, by the way, we're zipping right along. What are we doing when we get through working the steps? Without batting an eye, he said, you lay real still because you're dead. Either way, think about it. Those of you who knew Doc know that there were many lines that he was known for. The one on the plaque on the wall at 8111 says, the only reason you'll ever take another drink is because you want to. We didn't put the whole line up there. He said, the rest is. Doc also said, if you get in an argument in your head about whether or not you're going to take a drink, you're going to lose. You can't win that argument. If you get in an argument in your head about whether or not you're going to take a drink, you will lose. I heard that in here. Here, rather. But I didn't hear it in here. And I hadn't been sober but about 3 months, and I had to make a business trip to Washington, D.C. And I fortified myself with a meeting. Got up the next morning, had lunch with my sponsor, headed out to Hartsfield Airport, boarded that plane, and that plane had not cleared the ground till the committee meeting started up here in my head. 600 miles from home. Nobody up there knows you're an Alcoholics Anonymous. You can tie one on tonight, and by the time you get home Friday, you can have it all out of your system. You notice I didn't say you can have a drink. I wasn't that sick. You know, those voices are going here. Nobody will know. Yeah, you'll know. Yeah, but nobody up there knows you. And that, you know, I'm looking around the plane to see if other people are hearing those voices. They weren't. All the way up there, that committee's meeting. Yeah. I'm just listening, you know. Touchdown at National Airport, off the plane, into a cab, headed for one of those big hotels on Capitol Hill, out of the cab, into the lobby of that big old hotel, the meeting's still going. Yeah. Couldn't get a word in edgewise if I wanted to. Got in that lobby and my radar spots the bar over on the other side. You know, I could hear the music, the tinkling of the glasses, the music, the laughter. Took me less than 10 minutes to check into the room, came back and stood in the doorway of that bar while that meeting played out in my head. And nowhere in sight was Doc's admonition. You get into an argument in your head about whether or not you're going to take a drink, you're going to lose. And I lost. And after standing in the doorway 3 or 4 minutes, I walked over and I sat down at the bar. The bartender came and stood in front of him and looked down, paused a second, smiled, and then said something real weird. He said, "Hi, buddy, how about a Coke?" "And what?" He smiled again and pointed, and he said, "Well, I figured by that lapel pin you're wearing there, that's probably what you'd want. I'd forgotten to take off this damned AA pin." He set the Coke down, went down to the other end of the bar, served two or three other people, came back and stood in front of me again. I'm still sitting there staring at that Coke. He said, "You ain't got any business in here, do you?"
"No."
He said, "Where you belong is three blocks down the street, upstairs over the furniture store. There's a meeting in 20 minutes. Get the hell out of here." I went to that meeting that night, and I did two additional things. I walked back into a bar, and I thanked an angel in the shape of a bartender for saving my life. He laughed and said, "You weren't as much trouble as you thought." He said, "When I saw you standing in the door for so long, I thought you were looking for somebody. But when you sat down and I saw that pen and I saw the look on your face, I knew what you were doing. There was no way in hell you were going to get a drink out of me tonight." And the other thing I did is get down on my knees beside a hotel room bed in Washington. And I said, "God, if you've gone to this much trouble to keep me sober tonight, I will never test you again." And I haven't. I don't go in bars because I don't belong in bars. I've got no business in bars. I belong in rooms like this with people like you. People who know who and what I am. Who what makes me tick. Who knows when I get off center, you can correct my course like that in a way no bartender or no drunk in a bar ever could. And I got that from my sponsor as well. I can tell you, I remember one night we were sitting in a meeting at A111 or somewhere, and a young fellow in the course of his sharing in the meeting had shared that he and some buddies were going to go to a bar after the meeting. I poked a guy sitting next to him. I said, "Watch, Doc. Here he comes." I could see him raise up. He always looked like he was half asleep in a meeting, yet he could quote you everything everybody had said after the meeting was over. But he reared back up, and his hand shot up in the air, and he didn't even wait to be called on. He said, Hold it. "What'd you say about going to a bar? Back up on that." And the guy said, "Oh, no, we're not going to go drink. We're going to hear the band." Doc said, "Just buy their damn record." Kid said, "They hadn't got one." Doc said, "Then they're not worth listening to." He wouldn't let me con myself. I never understood it, what was in it for you people. I never understood what your motives were. Why did you care? I thought at first you don't even know who I am or what's going on with me. But I found out, thank God, that you knew exactly what was going on with me. And that when I said to you, "My name is Bill and I'm an alcoholic," you knew 99% of everything you needed to know about me. But I couldn't figure out what your motive was. Till one night, after a meeting, Doc said, "Come here." Or before the meeting, he said, "Come here, there's a young man here with a background similar to yours. He's got the same business you're in and everything. This is his first meeting. Stick around after the meeting. We're going to share with him a little bit." I said, "Gosh, Doc, thanks for thinking of me, but I tell you, I have had one heck of a bad day today. I am tired. I hadn't had a bite to eat, and I got a splitting headache. Catch me another time." He said, "You don't understand. You're staying. We're talking." Well, since he put it that way, I mean... You know. Two and a half hours after that meeting is over, I have to pull off the side of Roswell Road on my way home with tears streaming down my face, because suddenly I got it. I found out what was in it for you. And in that couple of hours, this egotistical, self-centered alcoholic had gotten out of himself and thought more about another human being than he did himself, and the feeling was unbelievable. I knew what was in it for you. I went home. By the time I got home, Doc had had time to get home. I grabbed the phone and I called him up. I said, "Doc, this is the greatest feeling I've ever had in my life. I can't believe how it feels. Just us sitting there talking and sharing." And I said, "You know what occurs to me? There are people in hospitals, and there are people in jails, and there are people in..." And that's when he said we need to discuss a thing called Easy Does It. But I have found this, and I would share with this with you tonight, that if you want to know the secret of being happy, and I believe, and it's the only time I'll take your inventory tonight, I believe that if you are not happier today than you have ever been in your entire life, then there is a hole in your program somewhere. I believe that. Because that book even tells us that we are supposed to be happy, joyous, and free. Does life still happen? Yes. Do crises still come? Yes. Does pain still come? Yes. But I have not had to face a single one of them alone in nearly 14 years. And you've promised me that I won't ever have to. But I think the secret of happiness in AA, and I'm going to pass this on to you so that you can start enjoying it if you hadn't figured it out for yourself. Every day of your life, make an effort to repay your debt to Alcoholics Anonymous. Just a little bit. Just pay back what you perceive that you owe AA. Now, there's a very strange thing that happens. The more you pay back, the more you get. And the more you get, the more you owe. So you got to work a little harder. And at the end of the day, what happens is you are deeper in debt, but richer. It's wonderful. And it keeps working and working and working. As many of you know, in November of 1985, my sponsor Doc went on a 12-step call and never came home. As he and another man struggled to take a shotgun away from a suicidal young alcoholic that Doc had been trying to help get sober, the shotgun accidentally discharged and Doc caught the blast full in the stomach and died on his way to the hospital. In the quiet stillness of that evening in Doc's den, as I stood staring out the window watching the sun go down, I felt a loneliness come closing in on me that I hadn't felt in a long time. And the thought going through my head was, how can I go on? How can I stay sober without the man by my side who kicked me, dragged me into and through these steps, who planted my feet into this fellowship, who taught me to get in the middle of the bed of this fellowship and to stay there? How can I go on without him? In the quiet stillness of that evening, the answer came very simply. You do it by doing the things he taught you to do, and that his sponsor taught him, and his sponsor taught him, and his sponsor taught him. All the way back to that fateful night, 61 years ago last month, when the broken-down stockbroker and the has-been doctor sat in the little gatehouse in Akron and said, do you think we might be able to stay sober if we help one another? I believe with all my heart that God, in his infinite and compassionate wisdom, in the spring of 1935, looked down and said, the lowly alcoholic has suffered long enough. He's been the outcast of society for long enough. I've got to give him a way out. And look at the way he gave us. He could have decreed that we'd be locked away in hospitals, or worse, in prisons behind bars, so that we couldn't harm ourselves or anybody else. He could have decreed that we'd be put off somewhere like lepers in a colony. He didn't do any of these things. Instead, he gave us each other, and more love, and more laughter, and more joy, and more happiness than most of us could have ever dreamed of in 100 lifetimes. And then it is my belief that he topped it off with something else. He topped it off with a one-on-one, face-to-face relationship with him that few people on this earth will ever know. That's why I believe we are the luckiest people who walk on the face of God's earth. I thank him every day for this fellowship. I thanked him in the weeks and years and months that were to come, because after Doc's death, I was surrounded by the greatest bunch of sponsorees that anybody could have. And those guys dragged me to meetings when I didn't want to go. They made me share when I wanted to isolate. And they walked with me until I could walk my walk again. And they're still there for me. And I learned one more time what that old man meant when he said, we sponsor each other. I love the guys that I sponsor. They're an intimate part of my life and of my sobriety. And I don't want to go a day without them. In closing, I would share with you, for some of you who don't know, the woman I referred to that I married in 1966 as my first wife. Because you see, I'm not married to the same woman anymore. And thank God, she's not married to the same man anymore either. They're the same bodies, but they are not the same people. You changed all that. On December 30th, 1982, the day when the final decree of divorce was to have been signed, instead, my wife and I stood in front of the same minister who had married us 16 years earlier, and in the presence of friends and family in this fellowship, we renewed our vows, and we started all over again. And the last 14 years have been fantastic. I love that woman more than anybody on the face of this earth. She's not here tonight. Normally she is when I chair, and she would like very much to be here, but she's involved in a convention in Florida, which began this afternoon and had to go down. But I can tell you this right now, that she is in Florida at this moment thinking about me, sharing with you as I am thinking about her. Yeah, we still communicate every once in a while. But making up's a lot more fun than it used to be. That woman is my soulmate. She's my partner. She's my pal. She's my best friend. She's my administrative assistant in my office, so we work together. We laugh together. We cry together. We sleep together. We love together. And you gave us that gift. And finally, a few years ago on a February Saturday afternoon, I took one more walk with my little girl. But this time it was down the aisle of a church. And she looked like a princess in that long white flowing gown as we walked down that aisle. And I looked just like a damn penguin in that monkey suit. And I cried all the way down the aisle. And I took my little girl's hand and I placed it into the hand of another man. And the two of them turned to face the same minister who had married her mother and me 25 years earlier. And the same minister who had renewed our vows 10 years before that. And they began their life together. And I love my son-in-law. He's very, very special to me. I worried a great deal the first night that I met him, because the first night we met him, we went out to dinner. And my wife and I and my daughter and Paul, and we walked in a restaurant and sat down, and the first thing he did was to order a beer. And then he sat there and nursed that thing for 2 hours. And got up and left half of it. And I said, son, you ain't never gonna make it in my little club drinking like that. And he won't. He's been to a lot of these meetings, though, and he knows what they're about. And he's here tonight, and I'd like for you to meet him. Paul, would you stand up? The greatest tears of that day, though, came not at the wedding, but at the reception. My daughter had the first dance at the reception with Paul, as well she should. And she'd said, Dad, I want to have the second dance with you. And I went, oh, geez. Maybe you better tell me what we're going to dance to so I can practice with your mom a little bit. Because, you see, I don't dance as good today as I never did. She said, no, I don't want to tell you. And she and Paul had their dance together, and the music ended, and my little girl came and stood in front of me, and she reached out her hands and took mine, and I looked in her eyes, and instead of fear and hate and disgust, I saw love and I saw respect. And we moved out onto the dance floor, and the music began. And the words of the song were, "Did you ever know that you're my hero and everything I'd like to be? I can fly higher than an eagle. You're the wind beneath my wings." Dear God, what a miracle had been worked in the lives of this family that had been ripped and shredded and torn apart by the disease of alcoholism. Destroyed. And yet meeting by meeting, sponsor by sponsor, step by step, you, God, and AA had put this family back together again. Don't ever use the word hopeless around this alcoholic. Been there, done that, survived it. Thanks to you, to God, and to AA. I love this fellowship. It's our lives in our house. It's the cornerstone of all that we believe in. I pray every day of my life a very simple little prayer. It's the same prayer I pray as I drive along the Chattahoochee River on the way to work and watch the fog roll across the river in the morning sometimes. The same prayer as I pray when I watch a sunrise. The same prayer I pray is when I see someone pick up a chip for a year or two or 10 or 30. It's the same prayer I pray when I see the miracle of recovery happen again and again and again. And the prayer is simply this. Thank you, dear God, because I almost missed all this. In closing tonight, I would think there couldn't be any wonder as to why I would close by saying to you, did you ever know that you are my heroes? And you are everything I have dreamed all of my life and wanted to be. And I believe that all of us can soar like eagles because he's the wind beneath our wings. God bless you. Thank you very much.